The lecture this evening is pretty ambitious, so I hope you've had some coffee. Not only am I going to kind of challenge the standard narrative that is the relationship of religion and modernity, I'm going to challenge it from several different angles. But what really interests me at the end of the day is a relationship between Christianity and Islam. That's what I'm currently working on. Haphazardly ended up in this area, but that's a long story and I only have an hour. I do really think that if Christians, in particular Catholics, but if Christians are going to engage Muslims on a real level, on a theological level, we both have to have a very critical re-examination of the Enlightenment and modernity, and there's a lot of fruit that can come from an interreligious encounter if we're able to critically engage our relationship to the Enlightenment together. But I'll get to that at the end. Okay, so this is a lecture roadmap. There are four parts to this lecture, as you'll see. The first is I'm gonna talk about the standard narrative of religion and modernity. I'm gonna use Mark Lilla, he's the big blotch. Mark Lilla is a stillborn god. Some of you have probably read it. I'm going to do a kind of quick sketch about the argument of that book. And then I'm going to challenge that narrative from within Christianity with Michael Buckley, a Jesuit, Philip Jenkins, who is an historian of religion at Penn State, and Ibrahim Kalim, who I'm not ascribing to his political views. He's a Muslim academic. He did write, he has had a problematic, I think, role in Erdogan's regime in Turkey, but he wrote a great essay on Christianity and Islam that I'm going to be drawing from. Okay, does that make sense as kind of the roadmap for the lecture? Thank you. All right, so step one, the standard narrative of religion and modernity. And we're going to start with Mark Lilla. This is a problem in a nutshell. Mark Lilla, this is from the New York Times from an op-ed essay in 2007. Though we have our own fundamentalists, we find it incomprehensible that theological ideas still stir up messianic passions, leaving societies in ruin. We had assumed this was no longer possible, that human beings had learned to separate religious questions from political ones, that fanaticism was dead. We were wrong. This is, in a nutshell, Lilla, and by the way, I'm not using Lilla as a straw man because I do really respect him. He's a great thinker. I think he's tone deaf to religious belief and practice. But this is kind of Lilla's approach to religion in a nutshell. He argues that there are two basic options for political theology in the West. The first is Hobbes's great separation, and the second is Rousseau's kind of more moderate option. Now, when I talk about Hobbes and Rousseau in this next section, it's kind of not important in some ways whether he's accurate vis-a-vis Hobbes or he's accurate vis-a-vis Rousseau. He's kind of drawing this grand narrative about modernity, and he's somewhat caricaturing Hobbes and Rousseau to serve this wider narrative that really is in the intellectual bloodstream, I think, that we all drink from. Okay. So Hobbes. So, according to Lilla, religious convictions, Hobbes's great separation. Hobbes writes that religious convictions so often lead to conflict. How do we contain potential violence for religious people? What should we do? We should turn away from God and toward the human person. In order to escape, this is Lilla writing about Hobbes. In order to escape the destructive passions of messianic faith, political theology centered on God was replaced by political philosophy centered on man. This was the great separation. So this is option one, is kind of in order to tame religious sort of messianic craziness, we're going to separate religion from political philosophy, we're going to center political philosophy on man. Hobbes, though, according to Lilla, there is a reaction to Hobbes because some people, namely Rousseau, but Rousseau and his followers, agreed with Hobbes' critique of Christianity in particular, but thought that religion was an inescapable element of the human experience. And to deny that, and to deny that kind of airing in the public sphere was going to have dangerous consequences. Were those, this is sort of gives voice to this reaction of Hobbes. Were those the only reasons that for a millennium and a half, an entire civilization had looked to Jesus Christ as its savior? Or that suffering Jews of the diaspora remained loyal to the Torah? Could ignorance and fear explain the beauty of Christian liturgical music or the sublimity of the Gothic cathedrals? Could they explain why all other civilizations, past and present, founded their political institutions in accordance with the divine nexus of God, man, and world? Surely there was more to religious man that was dreamed of in Hobbes's philosophy. Does that make sense? That Hobbes's philosophy kind of didn't capture the religious instinct of the human person. Rousseau and his friends wanted religion to play a central role, but religion is properly chastened and intellectually reformed. As in, if we could just kind of harness the crazy and give air to the spirit that builds Gothic cathedrals, we can have a fruitful political life together. So Rousseau, as I said, shared in the Enlightenment's criticism of Christianity, but he was a friend to religion. Faith in God is humanly necessary, according to Rousseau. Here's another quote, again, from Lilla, recounting Rousseau. Yes. Religion has its roots in needs that are rational and moral, even noble. In the abstract, this thought did not contradict the principles of the Great Separation, which gave reasons for protecting the private exercise of religion. But it did raise doubts about whether the new political thinking could really do without reference to the nexus of God, man, and world. If Rousseau was right about our moral needs, a rigid separation between political and theological principles might not be psychologically sustainable. And this is Lilla's argument, that the problem with the Great Separation is that it produced the stillborn God. He argues that the children of Hobbes and Rousseau, according to the children of Hobbes, a decent political life could not be realized by Christian political theology, which bred violence and stifled human development. The only way to control the passions flowing from religion to politics and back again was to detach political life from them completely. Those are like the children of Hobbes. And then for the children of Rousseau, this produces a stillborn God. To the decisive question, why be a Christian, why be a Jew, liberal theology offered no answer at all. So Kant, Hegel, liberal Protestant theologians, especially in Germany, for these people, they had faith in the core of Christian theology, faith in cultural and political progress, faith in the cultural and political progress that Christianity brought to the world, as in kind of individuality, moral universalism, reason, and progress. There could be no contradiction, though, between religion and state. By the turn of the 20th century, the liberal house was tottering, and after World War I, it collapsed. Liberal theologians signed on to the war efforts, and their students were horrified. They craved a more robust faith based on a new revelation that would shake the foundation of the moral order. Karl Barth is, and students of Karl Barth, a kind of a symbol of this rejection of 19th century liberal theology. Barth rejected any accommodation of the gospel to modern sensibilities. If you haven't read Karl Barth, I really recommend that you do. I have a student doing an independent study with me this semester on Barth, and I hadn't read Barth in a long time. It's just good for the soul. It's good Lenten practice, actually. I'll recommend Barth. I don't mean that in a... I mean, it's a really good Lenten practice. I didn't mean it. Well, okay. But others, just as messianic, signed on to Nazism. This confirmed Hobbes's iron law that messianic theology breeds messianic politics. So according to Lilla, the lessons learned are that this story also reminds us how political theology can be adapted to circumstances and reassert itself, even in the face of seemingly irresistible forces like modernization, secularization, and democratization. We have learned Hobbes' lesson too well, writes Lilla, and failed to heed Rousseau's, and so we find ourselves in an intellectual bind when we encounter genuine political theology today. Either we assume that modernization and secularization will eventually extinguish it, or we treat it as an incomprehensible existential threat. I think that reading that book, Stillborn God, Lilla threw out, while he doesn't end up on the kind of religion as an incomprehensible existential threat, he's in that zip code. You can definitely feel it, especially as he writes about Muslims. So he inserts Muslims into this story about religious fanaticism, and he writes, "It is a world in which millions of people, particularly in the Muslim orbit, believe that God has revealed a law governing the whole of human affairs." Like, can you believe it? "Agreement on basic principles won't be possible, and we must learn to live with that," he writes. And at the end of the book, it's really an unsatisfactory ending. He calls for kind of renovators, not liberalizers, because he kind of realizes that the children of Rousseau, he gets the problematic trajectory of the late 19th century European theology. And yet he really does not, he's just tone deaf to religious belief and practice, and he's afraid of its influence in the public sphere at the end of the day, okay? So this is the standard narrative of religion and modernity. Religion is frightening, it's messianic, it's got these irrational passions, and we need to harness it and tame it and kind of keep it out of the public sphere in order to maintain order. Does that make sense as a sort of standard narrative? Lilla standard narrative, okay. So for Lilla, religious extremism reveals the true nature of religion at the end of the day. That really the Muslim extremists, Islamic extremists, uncover something that is true kind of about religion writ more broadly. So that Islamic extremists are conveniently inserted into this standard narrative of religion and modernity. Lilla contends that if we cannot expect mass conversions to the principles of the Great Separation, and he argues that the U.S. is kind of an exception to this, we had better learn to welcome transformations in Muslim political theology that ease coexistence. So what's wrong with religion as extremism? Here I draw from Bill Kavanaugh's book, The Myth of Religious Violence, from 2009. Bill Kavanaugh shows this narrative has been a legitimating myth of the West. He argues that religious ideas are no more likely to set off violence than secular ideas. David Bentley Hart has also written really convincingly, I think, in this vein. The modern West invents the idea that religion is violent in order to justify violence in the secular orders. He writes, I think this is a really penchant quote, "Their violence is religious and therefore irrational and divisive. Our violence, on the other hand, is secular, rational, and peacemaking. And so we find ourselves regrettably forced to bomb them into the higher rationality." I thought that it's really penchant. It's a very good book, and he's a very good thinker. If you haven't read Bill Kavanaugh, maybe after Lent, read Kavanaugh. Okay. Step two. So we've got the standard narrative. Now step two, we're going to look under the hood of the standard narrative. We're going to take Michael Buckley in order to look at the same history and read it differently. Read it from the perspective of a religious believer. Does that make sense? Okay. And this is going to be quick and unsatisfactory, but we'll do the best we can. So for Buckley, there's another way to read this same history. Buckley writes two books on the rise of modern atheism, one in 1987 and the other in the early 90s, Denying and Disclosing God. And so this, what I'm about to talk about, is based on a reading of those two books. Okay. I teach a course on this, so it's really hard to like say it in a few sentences, but let me just come out here and see if I can just do this. I'm going to look at the slide with you. Okay, so can you hear me? Great. So for Schleiermacher writes this series of speeches called On Religion, Speeches to Its Culture Despisers. He's a pastor, but he's also an academic, and he's writing to kind of the intelligentsia, trying to convince them that religious belief is rational, but religious belief is palatable. It's a highly rhetorical set of speeches. It is, they're actually really good speeches. It's really easy to dismiss Friedrich Schleiermacher when one isn't reading Friedrich Schleiermacher. But if you sit down and you read On Religion, you feel yourself drawn into the persuasive power of these speeches. For Schleiermacher, religion is an aspect, an element of human self-consciousness. It is a dimension of what it means to be human. And he builds out a whole theology on that. He calls it the feeling of absolute dependence, although the word feeling is misleading in English. The feeling of absolute dependence that we fundamentally, if we look within, we can feel ourselves dependent upon the Creator. And then he builds out a whole theology in the Glaubens Lehre and in the Christian faith based on that feeling. And at the end of those five speeches, he ends up kind of smuggling in all these Christian categories back into this wider religious worldview. But what the point of the speeches is to try to convince these new atheists, these people who aren't convinced by the Christian faith, that the Christian faith is much more, it's not metaphysics and morals, it's not abstract thinking, it actually is an inescapable part of who you are. He writes this book in 1799. Hume, at the same time, writes a great dialogue, hate it, but it's really good, dialogue concerning natural religion, in which maybe the most adequate defense of religious belief comes in the voice of Cleanthes, who defends religious belief on the foundation of the fact that it's an explanatory principle of the world. And he doesn't get the best lines, but I'm not going to get distracted by the dialogues. So, for Schleiermacher, religious belief is an inescapable element of human consciousness because we can all understand that there's a feeling of absolute dependence in the core of who we are as human beings. For Hume, I mean, this is a rough and ready. I'm just talking about Hume and the dialogues concerning natural religion. If we're going to believe in religion at all, then religion is God is the explanatory principle of the world. That's the kind of, in terms of the table that he sets when he's talking about religious belief, that's the only possibility worth defending. And then we can have a conversation about at the end of the day whether he even agrees with that. But, okay. And then once religion becomes an explanatory principle for the world, you've got Descartes and Newton and Kant sort of refine that in each of their each of these different disciplines. Hold on. Religion becomes a universal norm, it's an explanatory principle. It becomes unnecessary once we find other principles to explain the universe, right? If religion, if God is the explanatory principle of the world, and then we find other principles in math, mechanics, and ethics, religion becomes unnecessary. Christian belief in particular becomes unnecessary. And then you get Feuerbach's Essence of Christianity, another great book. I hate it, but it is a really good book. Feuerbach writes that religion is an infantile crutch, and we need to free ourselves from it, because not only is it unnecessary, but it is dangerous, because we, in order for the human person, it's a complicated book, actually, but what we've done is we've taken the best in who we are, and we've put it onto to this God, make-believe figure, and then we've kind of smuggled it back into who we are, and we need to free ourselves from this infantile crutch in order to harness the human potential in kind of wider humanity. I mean, Feuerbach is like the quintessential Enlightenment thinker. You know, we can do it all. We just haven't been doing it at all. So let's free ourselves from religious belief, free ourselves from this illusion in order to harness the human potential.
I think Feuerbach is the basis, not only Freud's Future of Religion, I think is just a terrible book. I do not recommend reading it.
Oh.
It's got just horrific stereotypes about it. So Freud, I think, takes Feuerbach into the psychological arena. Marx takes Feuerbach into the economic arena. I teach Nietzsche's The Gay Science as well as a sort of another outgrowth of Feuerbach. But really, in terms of this narrative, Feuerbach is the foundation for religious as dangerous or extreme. So we've moved from religion as universal norms, as a principle for sort of an inescapable aspect of who we are, to religion as unnecessary, an explanatory principle for the world. Once we've found another explanatory principle, religion becomes unnecessary, and then it becomes dangerous or extreme. Do you see that trajectory? That is, in a nutshell, Buckley uses secondary historical figures, not these figures, but that's how he reads this history. He argues that the rise of atheism resulted from theologians losing their mettle in the face of scientific, especially Newtonian, breakthroughs. Atheism did not arise from theological disdain for modern science, but instead due to their uncritical embrace of it. Any attempt to understand religious traditions through this lens ignores the most fundamental aspects of religious belief. In Buckley's terms, this move brackets the religious. So this is one quote from the last two paragraphs of his book, Denying and Disclosing God. I'm going to read it and then I'm going to talk about it. One will not long believe in a personal God with whom there is no personal communication. And the most compelling evidence of a personal God must itself be personal. To attempt something else as foundation or as substitute, as has been done so often in an effort to shore up the assertion of God, is to move into a process of internal contradictions of which the ultimate resolution must be atheism. Okay, what is he not saying? Because I didn't give you the two paragraphs. He's not saying that we should just kind of neglect our rational side or at all. This isn't a fideistic appeal to religious belief. This is just the reason he ends there in his second book is that this is what's been neglected, this belief in a personal God. One will not long believe in a personal God with whom there is no personal communication. And so in order to defend Christian belief, we should, of course, harness all the kind of human disciplines to do that, right? But the foundation of religious belief is an encounter, fundamentally for Father Buckley, for Michael Buckley, it's going to be an encounter with Jesus Christ. It's that personal encounter that is at the core. And in any defense of that Christian belief, if it doesn't start there, if it doesn't recognize that, and the thinkers that we had on the previous slide didn't, right? I mean, Schleiermacher definitely had to kind of smuggle in Jesus toward the end as one of the possible mediators. But we're all mediators. We're all priests at the end of On Religion. But if once we don't let that be part of the conversation, then the whole thing is a house of cards and it comes tottering down. Does that make sense? It's an alternate reading. So he reads the same history, but he ends at a different place. Why? Because he's not tone deaf to religious belief, and he sees what happened. He sees that Christian theologians themselves became complicit in this Enlightenment project that made everyone really tone deaf to what religious belief is fundamentally about. Yes?
So that's step two. Okay. So now, let me just do a few sum up things so that we can have a little pause before we move to step three and four. So ironically, the attempt to make religion palatable to modern rationalists
pushed religious belief into the realm of irrationality, a realm that endangers the modern political order. So to sum up, Western assumptions about religion come in two forms. Religion is universal norms, and religion is extremism. The development of the first assumption directly led to the second. Both are dependent upon a founding myth of the modern that invents both the term religion, either by paring it down to a lowest common denominator of universal norms, or by associating it with irrationality and violence. Neither provides a fruitful way of encountering actual religious traditions or religious believers. Religion is attacked as extremist or ignored as superstitious. Now there's an added dimension. Muslims have been inserted smoothly into a fable about the death of religion in modernity. Modern Europeans who thought that the religious commitments of old had finally subsided are wrong. Modern Westerners assumed that since Hobbes and Locke, Hume and Kant had entered the European intellectual bloodstream, the rest of the world would follow suit and lay aside violent passions of religion. But this hasn't happened. The problem with Lilla is that he equates religion with superstition, irrationality, and extremism.
Okay, now I'm going to kind of blow up the narrative from the global South. I'm going to talk about Christianity first and then Islam. But first, so I'm going to let you all look at these slides. So Muslims, for example, are not just in Saudi Arabia, say, right? In terms of Muslim expansion. I'm going to say more about that, right? The global South, I'm going to talk about the global South in a minute, but the shift of Christianity has definitely shifted southward, and that's what I'm going to talk about now. Okay, worldwide observations. This is taken from Philip Jenkins' work. He's a historian of religion at Penn State, and he's really good at writing history, writing kind of the untold narrative. He's pretty contentious sometimes, but I find him really persuasive, especially really, really persuasive about the global South. He writes that Christianity, that's not how you spell Christianity, obviously, but began in the Middle East and North Africa. Today, Europe has the smallest number of Christians of any major region. Indonesia, a Muslim-majority country, has more Christians than all 20 countries in the Middle East and North Africa region combined. Nigeria has more than twice as many Protestants as Germany. Brazil has more than twice as many Catholics as Italy. About 90% of Christians live in countries where Christians are in the majority. And so I think that's one of the things that you noticed. Observations from the Global South. 100 years ago, the Global North contained more than four times as many Christians as the Global South. Okay, just like absorb that for a second. 100 years ago, the Global North contained more than four times as many Christians as the Global South. Today, 60% of Christians live in the Global South, and 40% live in the Global North. More Christians are in the Global South, but the concentration of Christians is much higher in the Global North, as in there are many more people in the Global South. So 69% of the population in the Global North is Christian. 24% of the people living in the Global South are Christian, but the total population of the Global South is 4.5 times greater than the population of the Global North. So that when we think of Christianity, we need to be looking southward instead of northward. According to Jenkins, we're really in the midst of a Christian renaissance, and we just aren't paying any attention. I find him really, really persuasive on this. Asia and North Africa were the heartland of Christianity for the first 1,000 years and probably until the 1400s. After this, Christianity became known as a Western religion when its roots were actually in the Near East. According to this myth, the origins of Christianity were in Europe and the Mediterranean world, with Jerusalem as the eastern extreme. And the authentic religions of Africa and Asia are Hinduism, Buddhism, Animism, and Islam. The reality is that Christianity has never been synonymous with either Europe or the West. And so part of this myth of religion and modernity is kind of rooted in a wider myth of Christianity being this colonialist European project. And if we actually look at the past 2,000 years of Christianity, and in particular pay attention to what's going on in the Global South right now,
we realize that Christianity has never really been synonymous with either Europe or with the West. And now, if we pay attention, Christianity is undergoing a radical renaissance in the global South. But it's a Christianity that we have a hard time kind of identifying. It's not as creedal. I'll talk about all this in a second. He talks about the effects of these changing demographics. When we say Christianity is waning, it's not just that we're wrong. It's that the opposite is true. So that if you think back to Lilla's kind of that assumption that once modernization and secularization takes hold, everyone's going to follow suit. We're living in the midst of this Christian renaissance, and yet we just aren't paying attention. So this is Jenkins. By 2050, some 34% of the world's people will be Christian, roughly what the figure was at the height of the European world hegemony in 1900. There is no single Southern Christianity. There's no such thing as a European or North American Christianity either, and it's not sort of one thing. Why should African Christianity be monolithic, and why should it resemble faith in East Asia? I was in Ghana this last week, and the Christian movements in Ghana alone are really complex and competing and important to pay attention to, I'll say, for a lot of reasons, but not just in Ghana, throughout the global South as well. Jenkins maintains, and this is somewhat true, but he's a little bit kind of, he paints with a broad brush. Global South Christians have a strong supernatural orientation. They're more interested in personal salvation than in radical politics. They spread in highly charismatic and Pentecostal forms. I certainly saw that last week. They have ecstatic religious styles. He says that we're living, possibly living among a new Reformation. Newer churches preach deep personal faith and communal orthodoxy, mysticism, and Puritanism founded on clear scriptural authority. They preach messages that are charismatic, visionary, and apocalyptic. Prophecy is an everyday reality. Faith healing, exorcism, and dream visions are fundamental parts of religious sensibility, of this religious sensibility. The dominant churches of the future, he says, could have much more in common with those of medieval or early modern European times. The global South religious movements are missing in Western conceptions of religion and modernity, and it's a real problem. In numerical terms alone, liberal Protestantism has never represented a mainstream of Christianity or even a majority, and as time goes on, the relative significance of that tradition will decline further, he projects. Ay, carajita, sorry. For the foreseeable, I think I forgot future, the dominant theological tone of the emerging world Christianity is traditionalist, orthodox, and supernatural. I have more to say on that. But this would be an ironic reversal of most Western perceptions about the future of religion, right? I'm going to talk extemporaneously after the next slide. He does this kind of, this is again one of the really persuasive parts of this book, is he writes about the late 7th, early 8th century spread of Christianity, but with Western Christians totally ignoring what was going on in the North. So the leaders, and he writes about this in this book, okay, the leaders, of the Western Roman Church, here a report of a traveler from remote Western Europe about new conversions in England and Germany. But these church leaders ask, is this new Christianity of Edessa or Damascus? That's the current sort of that was the current split in Christianity at the time. Where do they stand on the monothelite heresy that Jesus had two natures and but one will, not two wills according to the natures, or on iconoclasm? When the traveler tells them that these issues don't register there, where religious life has different concerns, the Syrians are alarmed. Is this really a new Christianity, or is it some new syncretist horror?
While Syrian Christianity debated these questions, the new churches of Europe grew widely. This is taken from chapter one. I think there's a parallel thing going on now with religion, in particular, I'm Catholic, of course, but in particular in my own church, it's not just a neglect about what's going on in the global south in Christianity, but it's the fact that Catholic believers in the global south don't necessarily fall into preconceived notions about what it means for brown or black believers to believe. And so when African bishops push against, in Amoris Laetitia, for example, when African bishops push against the Germans are startled, right, and don't kind of know what to do. I think we're living right now in my own church amongst a clash of worldviews. I'm from Argentina, and I remember when I was in graduate school here, an Argentine friend of mine came up to study theology at BC, and the faculty assumed that she was going to study liberation theology. She had no interest in liberation theology. But we have these preconceived notions about what Catholics in the global south kind of should believe, and they really don't fall along those preconceived notions in the least. And we are failing, it seems to me, at least in my own church, to pay attention to what's going on, to pay attention to the radical inroads that the Pentecostal Church, for example, and neo-Pentecostal movements are making in the global south, particularly in Africa and Latin America. Because we're obsessed with these northern issues about whether like three Germans will come back to church if they're allowed to receive communion after they divorced and remarried. I mean, it's absurd to me. I mean, so it seems to me that we're repeating this situation that happened in Jenkins recalls. Jenkins kind of writes out. It's an imaginative moment, but in 7th and 8th century Near Eastern Christianity. Okay. All right, so does this make sense as we're closing step three? We've set out the standard narrative. We've told the story differently from the perspective of a religious believer. And then we've now kind of blown up the narrative to show that religion and modernity, we're actually in the midst of a renaissance if we look at the global south, if we look at Christianity in particular in the global south. So the picture today is much more, is much sort of richer, and there are real possibilities, it seems to me, that those of us who are in the modern West, we have no way to account for what's going on in the global south vis-a-vis Christianity. Does that make sense as step three? Okay. So we'll move on to step four. Okay. So we're going to blow up the narrative from within Islam, but here I'm going to go really quickly. Worldwide observations about Muslims. Only 20% of Muslims today are Arab, about 100 million Chinese. There are about 100 million Chinese Muslims. The Middle East, North Africa has the highest concentration of Muslims in the world. They're 93% Muslim, compared with 30% in sub-Saharan Africa and 24% in the Asia-Pacific region. Muslims make up a majority of the population in 49 countries. Indonesia has the largest number, where 87% of the population is Muslim. Indonesia, not anywhere in the Middle East. India has the second largest Muslim population, where only 14%, they are, though, only 14% of India's total population. Just India has so many people, right? By 2050, the numbers of Muslims worldwide will grow to 30% of the world's population. The share of the world's Muslims who live in sub-Saharan Africa increases from 15% to 24% in 2050. Asia houses more of the world's Muslims, 62%, than all the other regions combined. That will continue, but with a smaller share. Okay. I'm just going to recommend a book. Those are really good vignettes, but we're running out of time. Shahab Ahmed, who taught here at Harvard, who unfortunately died, I think, at age 48, some years ago. God bless his wife, who has published several manuscripts of him posthumously. He wrote a book called What is Islam? It's a really big book. It's also really worth reading, in which he challenges so many Western attitudes toward what we think Islam is about. It's really, really rich. He talks about Islam as both coherent and conflicting. His main argument is that the texture of what makes Islam is much more kind of complex, and the width is much broader than we assume. But he does it on the ground. He does it really persuasively. And he's gotten criticized by so many quarters. I don't understand. It's a really great book. Not a summer beach read, though. Okay. So this is just, in a nutshell, a Whitman quote. Do I contradict myself very well? Then I contradict myself. Poetically speaking, what Ahmed's book is about, but I'm running out of time, so I can't go into it. So I'm going to talk briefly about Kalim. Okay, you know what? I'm just going to summarize Kalim. So Muslims and Christians fail to obtain a reasonable degree of communicative rationality as a basis for theological interaction. I'll talk about that. It is clear that both Islam and Christianity need to develop a religious discourse that would accommodate meaning and tradition on the one hand, and freedom and an open horizon on the other. His argument is that Islam has had a different relationship, a different encounter with the Enlightenment than Christianity has, and yet the Enlightenment and modernity and secularism kind of frame the table upon which Christians and Muslims are able to interact. And I've seen this, it's definitely in academia, it's a real problem that we have to, in order to come to the table to engage believers of other faiths, in particular Christians and Muslims, just in this case, but it's true more broadly, we have to kind of check our beliefs at the door and see kind of where we can meet. That's a really common, I have found that to be a really common way of approach in, especially in academia of religion. And he thinks we need to re-engage we need to both understand that we have related to the Enlightenment differently. Why? Because Muslims have absorbed the Enlightenment as a kind of neo-colonial Christian project. They've encountered the Enlightenment in a different way than Christians have. And they still live, I don't know if you read Charles Taylor's The Secular Age, but that Muslims still live in an enchanted world in a way that that Christians have kind of moved on to the buffered self. I mean, he doesn't use Taylor's language, but... ordinary Muslims still live in the sacred enchanted world. Muslim notions of reason, individual, family, universe, transcendent, and religion are imbued with a sense of the sacred that defies subjectivist epistemologies and secular ontology. To ordinary Muslims in the 19th century, modernization was a program of westernization underlined by secularism and European colonialism and missionary Christianity. So he thinks we need to re-engage the Enlightenment project, but from the perspective of religious believers. And you know, we do have a lot to say to each other. If we don't accept the terms of secular modernity and we're able to talk to each other from deep within our own religious houses of worship, there's a lot of work to be done. I have a lot to say about that, but that would be another lecture, and I've run out of time. Okay. So I'm going to end with Lemon Senna. Lemon Senna he died in the spring, last spring, a scholar of religion from the Gambia who was born a Muslim, converted to the Methodist Church, and the last 20 years of his life converted to Roman Catholicism. And he wrote about religion in Africa. And he writes in this biography of his called Summoned from the Margin, A Homecoming of an African. By necessity, we have to decipher other cultures, either on the basis of common humanity or on the basis of difference. Yet deciphering assumes a capacity for mutual recognition, just as the words on the page leap to life as they are mediated through attentive understanding. We find our way by such mutual deciphering. It is the answer to alienation.
letting Western secular assumptions about religion set the terms of encounter of those with religious belief is a crucial mistake. There is no settling for a secular intermediary that neutralizes the invited parties. Instead, religious believers should engage in an interfaith inquiry that uses one's own religious commitments as a portal through which to examine another's religious tradition. So to conclude, Lillo's standard narrative has been challenged from within Christianity. The heart of religion isn't extremism, but an experience with a personal God. That's Michael Buckley. From kind of Christian history and modern history, the inevitability of secularism is a European story. We're actually living among a renaissance of religious belief. From Islam, that Islam can't be equated with the Arabian world and with extremism. I haven't said enough about that, but I've run out of time. Western Christians need to realize that they bring enlightenment presuppositions to the table not shared by many Muslims. And these presuppositions need to be critically examined. They desperately need to be critically examined. The enlightenment distorts contemporary interfaith engagement. And I'll end with that. Thank you so much for your attention.
It seems to me that when people are talking about some kind of interfaith dialogue, the assumption is always, let's have a mystical epistemology that's theologically based. But to me, that's intractable. That's trying to swallow the sun. I'm wondering if there's anybody who's looking seriously at having an angelological mysticism to cross between Christianity and Islam, particularly with the central roles of Gabriel in both these religious structures.
I don't know of anyone in particular. I think that's a fruitful area of inquiry, and I would encourage you to pursue it.
Can we stay in class?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Perfect. And I'll tell you, I have more to say, but that's it. Yes.
I want to agree with you, but this sort of devil's advocate keeps popping up in my head. And it says that, the reason these people in the South and in Islam are religious believers and have this enthusiasm for religion, they aren't as far along in this evolution of sort of this progress, this progressive idea of how history is going. Even if we're not talking about ideological evolution, there's at least a progress of technology and domination of the natural world, which inspires wealth, which inspires decadence, which kind of saps the religious fervor out of people. So I'm kind of wondering, how do you respond to that?
I have a lot of different ways to respond to that. This might be a little unfair that I'm doing this, okay? But I can't resist this. So last week I stood in the dungeons of the castles at Cape Coast and the coast of Ghana and El Mena, the hub of the slave trade, where 48 million Africans passed through these castles, 10 to 12 of which have been made into the new world. Yesterday I took one of my four children and their friends to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. And so I was reminded about the horrors of the Holocaust. And you can read those horrors as the effects of modernity, technology, progress. So I do not share your optimism about, or your reading of what's, of course there's been progress and we have lights and I have a job and all that. I don't mean to deny all that stuff, right? I don't mean to deny it. But I think there's a deep, disturbing underbelly to the history of Western European modernity that we're beginning to contend with. So
I'm not defending that.
Right.
I'm not defending that. So
okay.
You think you're attacking, you're not. I'm saying that there seems to be this sort of direction. At least that's what your critics would say. I'm not necessarily
So I'll concede, that the biblical imagination was born out of an agricultural society, say, and of different core cultures, right? And that it speaks more
automatically to for an agricultural culture in society. I think there's a palpable that the Gospel of Luke speaks more palpably in Nairobi than it does in Cambridge. So that the roots of what we believe in, what I believe in, come out of kind of poverty and marginalization, yes, and that they have a purchase, a clearer purchase there than they do here, yes. I just don't buy the progress issue. And it might be that that, say, magically, the continent of Africa undergoes this radical economic restoration and expansion. And then Africans become less religious. I think underlying your criticism, that's progress.
I mean, I don't really believe it's progress, but
right.
it's material progress, right?
Right.
I mean, we have air conditioning, we have all this other stuff, and we don't have to deal with these deaths, not so much in our face here. Illness is put away on us, and
yeah.
put old people in home.
Right.
And, I mean, it's not moral progress, but it's a kind of a domination of the world
yeah.
that makes religion seem not as necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be. I will say.
And then you also seem to be conceding Nietzsche's point that Christianity is a slavery, at least to a certain extent.
Not in the way that Nietzsche writes about it, but yes, yes. I'll just end with Jenkins. Also, I think writes provocatively more than persuasively, but writes about pockets in Europe, at least, of reemergence of religious belief that we're also not paying attention to. So it could be. That even the decline that we're seeing in Western Europe and definitely in the United States, we're seeing kind of new growth from that cement that has possibilities, I think, for the future. Yes, in the back here, yes.
I'd be interested in your perspective on the sustainability of the charismatic forms of Christianity
yeah.
that are spreading across the earth. I mean,
yeah.
especially as a Catholic, right?
Right.
With a quick question about Jenkins, I think you said believes that future versions of Christianity might look more like
right.
medieval versions of Christianity.
Yeah.
Medieval
and
versions of Christianity weren't charismatic like, as much. Like there was
right.
it was liturgical. So
that's right. That's right. That's the least persuasive part, I think, of Jenkins' book. In that way, he has his own caricatures. I'll say. But on the piece about the charismatic movements, I think there's a lot of work to be done from the Catholic Church to respond to these movements and respond to the needs of people who are drawn to these movements. I had lunch with a Ghanaian bishop last week who I had accosted, unfortunately, not knowing who he was, but I'd seen his Roman collar and his ash Wednesday, and I hadn't gotten mass and I needed ashes. And then it turns out the next day he's sitting next to me and he's a bishop. Oh my God. But anyway, I talked to him about these neo-Pentecostal movements. And I don't know anything about Pentecostal theology, but I do know that I need to learn about Pentecostal theology and that there's a lot to be learned there and that Catholics need to take Pentecostal theology seriously. That I know, but I'm speaking as somebody who hasn't read that yet. I know that there are these neo-Pentecostal movements that are less kind of rooted in sort of Orthodox Pentecostal theology that are problematic from within Pentecostal movements themselves. The point about this bishop is that he said to me, because I asked him this question about the Catholic Church is bleeding members to these neo-Pentecostal movements who are also preaching that prosperity gospel. It's really disturbing in a lot of ways to me, I will say, these billboards all over the place. And he said that it is true that we are bleeding, but some come back because after these initial enthusiasms, and he said, I swear we do allow clapping and dancing. But some come back because it's that sustained ritual of Catholicism that some are sort of drawn back to. And so I think there's hope for that.
Do you think the term enlightenment to describe that particular period of history is a fair description, or do you think it's kind of an anti-religious motivated nomenclature?
Yeah, I agree. Yes, but it's what we've got.
Right.
So it's what's in currency, so we kind of have to use it. But that's a really
good. Because every time you use it, it kind of cements
yeah.
kind of anti-religious
it's kind of a parody term, actually. You know, I mean, Thomas More talks about how, you know, when you get a corrupt bishop and you call him your eminence or whatever you call him,
yeah.
you're actually kind of making fun of him.
Right. Yes. Sorry, did you agree on that?
Yeah. Is your hope to position Catholicism as kind of bridge between liberalism and Islam? Because you share some things with both, right? That Catholicism and Islam are both, they're illiberal creeds on some level, right? They have imperatives that are higher than liberal imperatives. But it's got more of a comfort with rationality that we can impose virtue, but there's a limit to how much we're going to impose it on society. We want to make virtue possible, but not mandate it.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the book that's just coming out. What You Say is in my chapter one. I welcome Cameron Alford on that very exact issue. Yes.
I'm just wondering how much heterodoxy would the Catholic Church really allow for these churches in the global South? There have been attempts, for example, in India among my ancestors to incorporate, you know, their Hindu origin rituals into Christianity, and those had to be brought back to the straight and narrow path by the inquisitors, instruments of torture. So, and you know, it's like even in sub-Saharan Africa, there's the reason for supernaturalism is because they were already many of them animists before, and you know, that sort of thing is sort of like in their traditions, right? And just looking at in the broader future, how would the church like be able to really rein in all these Catholic communities when we start colonizing the stars? I mean, if you had Near Easterners, clerics worried about Europe, Western Europe, then what about when we start colonizing Europa or something like that? Is that good, you know?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. It's an impossible question to answer. It's, though, however, not a new question, right? So it's a question from the dawn of Christianity, whether the followers of Jesus should be that the adult male should be circumcised. You know, so from the dawn of Christianity, we've been dealing with questions of the encounter of our faith with the culture in which it's embedded. So at least we've got a 2,000-year history, but that doesn't make any of these current contemporary issues any easier to confront. I don't have a broad answer. It seems to me it has to in some ways be an ad hoc answer. I think the church's theology of private revelation, of Marian apparitions, are a good model. Nobody talks about the theology of private revelation. No self-respecting Catholic theologian would talk about, you know, write about Marian apparitions. But
Marian apparitions on Mars.
Sorry? Marian apparitions on Mars, right. But in the church's theology of private revelation, we have a recognition of the push and the pull, and a possibility, an openness to on-the-ground movements that we kind of allow to happen, a caution on the part of magisterial documents, and yet there is, it seems to me, an openness in the theology of private revelation. God has spoken in history, and we have to be open to that continual unfolding of revelation that we're continuing to understand. I'm not saying that the canon is open, but I think the category of private revelation offers a possible foothold in that issue. Yes.
And how is the approach that you mentioned at the end of a better dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and how is it similar or different from what ecumenism is the type of ecumenism that is done by the church today, like Pope Francis, Pope John Paul II. So is that the idea, or are there some differences?
So that's a really big question, because there's been a lot of really, both John Paul II and Pope Francis have written some really great documents, right, on these interfaith and ecumenical encounter in particular. But I have a lot to say about each of them in particular documents, and so it's kind of an impossible question to answer. So, for example, in 1986, when John Paul II goes to Assisi and has an International Day of Prayer for Peace, you know, he kind of does that without thinking about what the hell that means. Like, what are we all doing here? What does it mean to pray for peace together? Who are we praying to? You know, Benedict kind of dialed back some of that, it seems to me. Anyway, so I have a lot to say, but it's a, in general, yes, but it depends on the particular.
Can you just say something more about that creates some, I mean, just a moment, because I'm wrestling with the person, sort of, that makes Islam today more sympathetic to a Christian mind? I mean, admittedly, I'm probably thinking of the most terrible kind of Islamic extremism.
Right.
But to create a kind of sympathy of interest, I don't know.
Right. So,
maybe it's too big a question, but because you didn't get to the last four.
Right.
I sort of got frustrated. I thought I'd hear something about that.
Right. Okay. So I can, I'll answer to personal.
Yeah.
I started teaching a course on the birth and early development of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam about 12 years ago. And I've learned that it was ridiculous that I was teaching this course. Like, they should have fired me. But I learned an enormous amount through teaching that course. It's become much more theological and historically driven.
Sorry, what was the name of the course I missed?
Sorry, Jews, Christians, and Muslims in Dialogue,
okay,
is what it's called. It's on these three traditions, Abrahamic traditions, because
yeah,
we all claim to be heirs of Abraham. Through the experience of teaching that course, I started to write, I started to be involved in this scriptural reasoning movement that I don't know if they've got any, if there are any groups meeting in the Boston area, but it's Jews, Christians, and Muslims reading scripture together, reading the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and the Quran on particular topics without having the burden of me representing my own, my perfect Catholic tradition in these kind of temporary tense of meetings. I've been really affected by the scriptural reasoning movement, so much so that I became more open to reading the Quran, I mean myself, right, through this encounter with people of other faiths, again, without having to check my own beliefs at the door. And then I had to think about how to teach the Quran as a sacred text, not my own sacred text, but as a sacred text to students at Villanova, because I didn't want to take a sociology of religions approach. And that has led me to, and that ended up leading me to write a book about Muhammad, God knows why, but, I mean, not I know why, but I started to learn about Muslim religious traditions, Muslim theology, about the Quran, and that has made me personally more sympathetic. I will say, though, that sitting around the table with Nigerians last week and listening to these grown men fight back tears talking about Boko Haram in northern Nigeria and these extremists who run into churches and scream Allahu Akbar before torching them down and torching villages down, right? I don't mean to minimize that reality, and yet I have come to get to know Muslims that are extremely different from that, right?
I ask you, being a 16th Sunni and Shiite, and you say Muslim.
Right.
You always talk
right,
about
so
this without reference. It's rather important.
Right, of course. I mean, I've learned from Sunni and Shiite Muslims, and Sufi Muslims as well. What I'm saying is that I've come to learn the radical plurality within Islam.
Yeah.
in a way that it takes a lot of time to learn, right? So I can't give you like a couple of sentences, but I can encourage you to start by reading What Is Islam by Shahram al-Fatih.
Yeah, no, I'm interested in that.
That's a really good place to start. Again, it's not a summer reading, but it's a good place to start.
And it'll be summer reading.
Yeah.
So you gave us four steps. I'm hoping for a fifth step in here somehow. Mm-hmm. So you started with the...
That'd be really long. But
with the conflict between modernity and Christianity. Is there a reconciliation of that other than to pick up your family and move to the global south?
I do think there are pockets of resistance and sort of enclaves in the global north, and I'm particularly involved in a few of those. Lebanon, for example.
Could you say that again?
There are some pockets of resistance in the global north, and I'm involved in some of them, so the lay Catholic movement, for example. I find the parish as a center of both raising children in the faith and transmittal of the faith that to be almost lost in the global north. I mean, I think I have a lot more hope for these lay Catholic movements. I think the Catholic education system too is just not what it was, and we haven't come to terms with that. But so I think there are possibilities, but they're at the micro level, not